That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
Well, that's what she said.
Hello, and welcome to the latest edition of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm really excited. I've been talking about having today's guest on for quite some time. It feels like whenever any topics come up in regards to masculinity in sport or society, gendered roles and the sort of standard constrictions that we use for men and women and how they can affect us. Whenever that comes up, I always say, I gotta have Don McPherson on. And he came to speak a couple years ago at an ESPNW summit and just blew me away. And those of you that listened to my previous podcast with Dr. Richard Lapchick, and if you haven't, please go back and find the pod with Dr. Richard Lapchick. He's just one of the most impressive, astounding, inspiring people I've ever had the chance to meet and speak to. He was a mentor for Don, today's guest. And so I think you'll hear a little bit of overlap in terms of the sort of direction they took their lives in connecting sport to the rest of society, and also their views of how we can change the sort of restrictions that we put on both men and women in society by way of established gender roles. So this is a really interesting conversation, and it's from an interesting voice, a great football player with a storied history in the NCAA and a pro career. So keep that in mind as you're listening, right? This idea of the role that great athletes and accomplished athletes can have in taking the entitlement and the power that comes with their success on the field off of it and doing big things. So hope you enjoyed my conversation with Don McPherson.
That's what she said.
You guys have heard me mention him on the pod before and say, I need to get this guy on to talk about some of this stuff. But I'm so happy to have Don McPherson on. He was a Maxwell Award winning, Davey O'Brien winning, second in the Heisman voting quarterback for Syracuse, went on to seven seasons in the NFL and the CFL. And when he retired, got into sports and society and the ways in which he could use the power of sports for outreach in terms of feminism and fixing the gendered violence in our country and the roles that we assign to men and women. So I'm so excited to have him on. Thanks so much for talking to me, Don.
It's my pleasure, Sarah. Been a long time.
So, yeah, let's start with the beginning, because I first heard of you and found out about you when you came to speak at an ESPNW summit. And you spoke a little bit about your background, but I'd love to go back to the beginning and hear about what kind of kid you were when you were growing up.
You're going to go back that far.
Yeah.
You know, I was always sort of a little bit of you know, my parents would say I'd walk to my, to the beat of my own drum. I was the youngest of five. I had two older brothers, both were professional athletes. One was a boxer and the other was played for the San Diego Chargers, and, two sisters, you know, typical middle class family on Long Island. My father was a cop, my mother was a school nurse at the school I attended. And I was sort of the youngest of five, and, you know, just like the youngest of five is like being the third string quarterback on a team, you know, with a star starter. You just sort of get forgotten and left out of a lot of things. And so I just got used to sort of looking at the world from my own lens, but having this family in front of me, like I said, middle class African American family on Long Island, lots of privilege, but yet growing up a black kid at the end of the civil rights movement and understanding sort of racism on a global spectrum. So I had a lot of perspective, and I grew up in a Catholic school originally and then public school. And so a lot of diversity growing up. And so I had a real strong lens on sort of where I fit, because I felt like I was watching life. And I guess maybe that's why I was a bit of a recluse and a bit of a quiet kid.
Yeah, but you were a tremendous athlete, which we don't always necessarily attribute to the shy kid. When you got to high school and you really started to blossom in track and field and football, did that change your personality, or were you still just a very thoughtful person who put work into sports?
I think you phrased that perfectly. I was still the sort of, because I after my freshman year of high school, I transferred to a different school that had a better football program. The high school that all my siblings went to had a really good basketball program, won a state championship a number of times, and I was getting better at football. I transferred to a high school where most of the kids I played Little League went to high school, but it was a predominantly white high school. And so once again, I was making this, you know, as the story goes, this hour and a half long trek to school every morning to a school that was predominantly white. I was sort of an outcast outcast in some regard socially, but at the same time was welcomed in because I was a football player. And so I started to see that privilege that being a member of the football team gave me, and I didn't like it. It made me a little uncomfortable because I began to realize that my value was primarily as an athlete and not really as a person, although I had a good circle of friends around me. Sort of that larger narrative was not lost on me. And so I was very, very introspective at that time and started to understand that I had a talent. I loved to play. But again, this was, you know, a time when I was really sort of trying to come to terms with some of the politics around myself as this gets into sort of the next phase of going to college. It was the early 80s, and as I tell people all the time, I wasn't a quarterback. I was a black quarterback. And so I was very aware of that as a high school kid in 1981, 82, that there were very few Vince Evans, Doug Williams, Joe Gilliam, just a few black quarterbacks in the NFL at the time, and even fewer at the kind of schools that I was being recruited by.
So what was your experience like at Syracuse? Obviously, you had tremendous success. You ended up in the NCAA College Football Hall of Fame because of your sport accomplishments. But what was it like being on the team, being a black quarterback, being at the school in general during that time?
It was, I think my experience was like a lot of student athletes, where you go in with very high hopes of being a scholarship kid and a, you know, high school All-American, and you think you're going to go in and just save the world. And I had injuries my first two seasons, thought about transferring, went through the ups and downs academically. I think it was very typical in a lot of ways. I was fortunate to have a coach who wanted me to play quarterback and did not ask me to switch positions and put that additional pressure on me. But that's also when I began to look at the experience of a college student athlete very differently. And as I define my experience, even though I still do work with Syracuse University, I love my alma mater, but my experience was I played football at Syracuse and was required to attend classes. And what I mean by that is that, you know, football was the 8-hour a day job, and we got 4 hours a day to squeeze in classwork in the morning, and then, you know, and find time to study in the evenings. But, you know, we were really there to play football. And so I don't say that as a complaint because I really did enjoy that experience.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, because I think that always trickles into conversations about whether NCAA athletes should be paid. People, oh, they're paid in education. And you're like, if they're at a high enough level, that education is coming very rarely and only when it doesn't interfere with the sports. So you don't leave with the same, you know.
Yeah, and I agree with that, but I also don't think that student athletes should be paid. I'm actually working on, I've been working on something in that regard for a number of years, but I don't think they should be paid. I think what we should do is stress the benefit of an education, which I think is what's lost. I'm 53 years old, and my experience as a student athlete at Syracuse really doesn't mean much if I don't have the education to leverage that experience in the aftermath. And I think that's the part that's missing. I think people who think that actually the athletes should get paid, in my opinion, it becomes a very condescending, and in some cases, in some programs, I think it's also that there's a fair bit of racism to it. It's what George Bush said many years ago, the soft bigotry of low expectations, that they should be paid because this is all they can do and this is their last chance. Well, no, most students go to college, get an education, and their life blossoms. When it comes to athletes, we have this notion that when they come to college, that's it. And that therefore, and I'm not saying that they're not huge financial earners for the institution, but that's always been the case. And the money is obviously exponentially bigger, but it's always been the case that alumni giving went up during, if a team went to the Final Four or if a team won a championship or even won a conference championship. What we really do fail student athletes by not emphasizing, the absolute utter importance of an education.
Yeah. So what did you say you were working on something in regards to that will be out soon?
You know, I've been struggling with it for a number of years because it sort of got bigger than me in many ways. And the issue just came from a conference on financial empowerment. But I really believe that in today's dollars, my experience at Syracuse is worth close to about $350,000, $400,000 if you looked at the aggregate that's spent on a student athlete. That's a tremendous amount of money that's around my life, and this notion that athletes are not getting paid or there's not this huge dollar amount that's already invested in them. I had a friend who works at a school, and the women's basketball team scholarship student athletes were complaining about, you know, all the stuff that they don't have. And she said, you know what, your scholarship is worth more than my salary.
Yeah.
And so your job is to play basketball and go to class. Right? But what we miss is that there's this economy around students that we don't point out to them. So if you say that you got a free education, then you learn nothing from it. But if you show students that their dollars that go into their lives are part of the economy, no different than living in a home with a family. And your kids don't realize that when they say, hey, just put it on a credit card. Or they don't realize that you're paying a mortgage, or that you're paying for the Wi-Fi that comes into the house. So one of the mistakes that we often make is that we try to teach financial literacy by saying, hey, if you save this and this, you can buy a house in 30 years. Well, a 15, 18, even a 20-year-old kid's not thinking 30 years down the line. They think about the weekend. And so there's this economy around college student athletes that we don't teach them, and there should be a tool that teaches them how to look at the economy around them as a teaching tool.
Well, I look forward to hearing what you have to say on that. I don't necessarily agree, but there's so much more that I want to talk to you about, which is why I'm glad that you're working on it, because then, you know, maybe I'll have you back and we can talk about that specifically.
Absolutely.
So you leave Syracuse and you end up getting into sort of the search for a pro football home. You were in seven different spots. What was your time in the NFL and the CFL like, and what did you learn, and maybe how did that influence what you decided to do after? Did you already know in college that after sports you would want to do something that uses sports to help society?
Well, I wasn't in seven places. I was only in four, thank goodness.
Oh.
But I left Syracuse, and before I graduated, I was actually a sophomore in college. I started doing programs, a New York State program called the Athletes Against Drunk Driving. And I realized at that point that we don't have honest conversations with young people about really critical issues, all the issues that I always say that we're all raised not to talk about. And so the platform that sports gave me to talk about those issues as a college student, I really fell in love with the process of talking to young people. And so I got drafted by the Philadelphia Eagles, and once again, you know, in that same vein of coming out of high school, I sent a letter to all 28, there were only 28 teams in the NFL at the time, all 28 general managers saying, if you're not going to draft me as a quarterback, don't draft me. Because I was not interested, nor was I capable of playing another position, but that was the, that was always the thing about black quarterbacks. Well, you could be a wide receiver or a defensive back. So ended up in Philadelphia, continued to do programs in New York State in high schools while I was playing in Philadelphia, got traded to the Houston Oilers for half a season, and then up to the Canadian Football League. And all those years, I continued to do work during the off seasons and when I could on different social issues, got involved in a leadership program in New York on Long Island, and continued to work with their program, brought it up to Canada when I was playing in the CFL, and started doing that work, during off-season up in Canada, and then retired in 94 and went to work at Northeastern University at the Center for the Study of Sport and Society.
So you would say it was a combination of your family, your upbringing, your realization in high school that sports afforded you this position from which to influence, right or wrong, and your time at Syracuse, particularly working with the drunk driving initiative, that sort of compelled you to use your power in sport even throughout your pro career? Because there are not a lot of, there are plenty, but not all professional athletes, while simultaneously caring about their own personal achievements and staying on a team and getting paid, are already thinking ahead to how that power can be used for better. What do you attribute that very clear motive for you?
Well, I think it was a combination of as I said earlier, and I think it's an important sort of part of my history, even though it's not something that weighs on me, is I was a child of the late of the end of the civil rights movement, and so I understood being black, being a black man in America, if you will. But then all of a sudden, I had this privilege of sport, and it helped me see the hypocrisy of of a lot of things around me, including a lot of people around me who valued me only in this way. And then when I was asked to talk to young people about issues that adults were not talking about. So the same adults who were drinking and driving in front of their kids were asking me, the football player, to go talk to their kids about drinking and driving. As I always say, I was always talking to kids too young to drink and too young to drive about the behavior of the adults in their lives. And I saw even more hypocrisy from our culture that was asking young people to make good decisions around difficult issues and doing so by not giving them good information. And that ran counter to everything that I understood about being an athlete and making good decisions on the field. Well, we drill incessantly on making good decisions on the field. Why don't we apply that same, or in the classroom, or in theater, or anything else where we want excellence? Why don't we apply those same principles to asking young people to make good decisions around drugs and everything else that at the time I was dealing with, and now getting into issues of sexual and domestic violence? You really have to train people to make good decisions. People aren't inherently aware of how to make good decisions around social issues.
Yeah, absolutely. So you got to the Center for Study of Sport and Society, and what was your focus there?
So I got to the center as a black quarterback, and went to work with Richard Lapchick, whose father signed the first black player in the NBA in 1950, mm-hmm. and Richard Lapchick, the great social justice icon around issues of racism in sport, and that's where I went to work primarily with Rich. But I got there and met this guy named Jackson Katz, who is one of the foremost voices on masculinity and the issue of men's violence against women. And it was the first time that I had heard a man talk about patriarchy and sexism, misogyny, homophobia. But more importantly, the first time I ever heard a man talking about masculinity. I'm writing a book, and I have a chapter titled 29. And it was because at 29 years old, I knew what it meant to be black. I knew what it meant to be a New Yorker when I went to school at Syracuse, or to be a football player on a college campus, or an American when I went to the Canadian Football League. I knew all the impact of all these different social levers on who I was as a person, but I never looked at masculinity. I never looked at the social constructs of masculinity until I was 29 years old and heard Jackson Katz frame that understanding in the context of how it impacts violence against women. And talk about a moment in your life when you think you're this person who can help people with your voice and your platform, and then you recognize this glaring omission of your understanding of yourself. And that was, for me, what happened in 1994 when I got to Northeastern and I heard this message about the impact of what I refer to as narrow masculinity and the issue of men's violence against women. From that moment on, my life, I'm not going to sit here and say my life has ever changed and it was this great epiphany, but it really was a moment where so much of my life was put into context and really work that I'll do forever.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. The idea, essentially, I would love you to expound on it, that sort of the standard constructions that we have for masculinity and femininity both limit women in the obvious ways, but also restrict men and can end up resulting in so much of what we struggle with in today's society, whether that's the shootings or, as you mentioned, the gendered violence, domestic violence, stalking, rape, et cetera. So talk about sort of, for those who may not have been enlightened to the idea of masculinity, what you heard that day and how it made you reframe things.
The conversation can get very complicated and very complex when you start talking about gender identity and identity, period. You can get, you can go back and look at folks who have studied personality and personality disorders and psychology. You can go in many different ways. You can look at what the feminist movement, unearthed in talking about gender constructs and social constructs of gender. But to me, and at the time I learned it, and also my charge of talking with men and young men about issues of masculinity and violence against women, it became very simple. And I started to look at, when did I learn and truly understand, and how did I learn what it meant to be a man? And for me, as a former athlete, I thought back to the early days as a kid, and a question I've asked men for the last 25 years: what was the worst insult we ever heard as a little boy? Because this is how far back it's learned. And it was, you throw like a girl, you run like a girl. It was the word. You can call a guy, that's my dog, he's a cool cat, right? You can refer to a guy as an inanimate object or an animal very often, and it's a compliment. but you compare us to our sisters, and it's the ultimate insult. That's mm-hmm. the core of misogyny. And I say that at a very fundamental early age. Guys do it now as adult men, and we joke about it, we laugh about it, but it has impact because as an early age, we learn the lesson that, A, being a man is being tough and strong. It's really, I refer to it as being narrowly defined. Because there aren't many ways that we really, and you mentioned how sexism impacts women. We don't look at how sexism impacts men. And the sexism that says to men that we have to be tough and strong, we can't show our emotions, we can't cry. So there's this narrow definition of masculinity that harms men. And then the second side of that insult or that charge or that challenge you throw like a girl, you run like a girl, is you're saying that women and girls are less than. And I always say that we don't raise boys to be men, we raise boys not to be women. Hmm. Because we don't tell boys that being a whole man is being loving and caring and sensitive and empathetic and vulnerable. But we tell men is just don't be that. And so that leads to men's violence against women because we see women as less than. And it also leads to our cultural silence because men are not going to step outside of that narrowness of masculinity to stand up and defend not just the position of women, but the idea of women. And so it's a very fundamental lesson that we learn at a very early age, and it gets reinforced in a multitude of ways. And this is not just in the context of sport, but in a multitude of ways in our culture of women being less than, and men also. This is one of the reasons why men are having trouble with this, the Me Too moment, is because we're looking at what men's response needs to be in the context of preventing violence against women as opposed to what men's response needs to be in the context of how do men change the behavior that's leading to the violence.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I wrote a story a couple years ago. I called it The Inequality of Insults. The idea that in most of our professional sports leagues now, there is actually language that that allows for fines and ejections for homophobic language, racial slurs, any number of ways that you can insult somebody through words, except for anything relating to women. To
Correct.
The point where a couple years ago, Chicago Tribune back page had Chris Pronger of the Flyers in a dress as a sort of insult leading up to their playoff series with the Blackhawks. And for even a paper that you would presume had a pretty evolved editorial board to still think that that was the best way to insult him was to make him look like a woman mm-hmm. kind of blew my mind. And why do you think it is that women are sort of the last place where we don't even fight necessarily to separate the language the way that we do? We understand how it affects LGBTQ people, how it affects people of minority groups or different races. But with women, we just sort of accept that, oh yeah, well, that women can be used as a synonym for inferior or weak.
Well, that's always been the goal of people in power. The way that power maintains itself is to, one, not be exposed or challenged. The other way the power is maintained is by pitting those who don't have power against one another. And so you had this, when women were fighting for gender equality and women, for example, Title IX was written in 1972, and it really did not have any teeth until 2011 when the Dear Colleague letter was written and it started to be applied on college campuses in a way that really did enforce with regard to gender equity on college campuses. Obviously, there was the Brown case many years ago, but where Title IX really started to have some really serious teeth in 2011 around the issue of women's safety on college campuses. And part of the reason why laws like Title IX and to your question is that women were pitted against one another. And feminists were seen as being man-hating, and that disrupts patriarchy. That disrupts the notion that when you attach patriarchy to religion, that man is the head of the household, and religious dogma gets attached to that as well. So all of a sudden, women were disrupting the family. They were disrupting social order, and so they were seen as being villains to society. And so there were a lot of women who, as well, were saying, "Well, we don't want that, right? We don't want to completely disrupt society. We don't want to disrupt the family." And so, women who were fighting for equity were seen as being villains to society. And that's one of the reasons why, how patriarchy gets maintained is by pitting women against one another, which we see now when women come together. So what happened in, over the last year wasn't just women coming together under one umbrella, whether it was for fair wages in the workplace, but it was all the disparate groups of whether it was fair wages in the workplace, whether it was reproductive rights, whether it was domestic violence and sexual assault. It was women coming together under a multitude of categories of women fighting for gender justice and equality that came together, and all of a sudden now we have this groundswell of women coming forward.
Yeah, and you know, the thing we often hear is, you know, if you come from a position of power, equality feels like oppression, right? So the idea that the demand for equal treatment and respect and rights to those who have always had them and don't want to give them up, it feels like you're trying to take something from them. But you know, as you know, you say it's not a pie. We don't run out of pieces. There's room for everybody if we're all on the same page. But how do you do the work then to convince people who are in power and have always been in power that that's not the correct way and that there should be a more equal distribution of who gets to decide how a society works?
Well, I think the question of power and what you just said, I think, about privilege is a really important conversation, and I'm working on this book, and I've actually started to change the title, playing around with the title. One of the concepts that I write about a lot is what I refer to as the blind spot of privilege, and even the blind spot of power, because it has been defined by men. And as you said, if you feel like you have power, the notion is we're taking something away from you to give to somebody else. And the reality is that there's this blind spot of privilege, there's this blind spot of male privilege that is really killing men. And I'll give it to you in sort of the case of a former Syracuse football player. He played at Syracuse. He worked at Syracuse. Had a great job. He checked the box on all kinds of privilege and power. Local guy, all the power and privilege. And he died a few weeks ago in Syracuse. One of the many former football players who played in the NFL who's now dead. I played with 32 guys and know 32 guys that I played with and had been around the game who never made 50. And that's way too many people to know in a circle, as a 53-year-old man to know so many men. And part of what happened with them gets to some of the same links to the issue of men's violence against women. A lot of people will disagree with this. A lot of people will try to say, oh, no, these guys are all dead because of CTE and the game is horrible. Well, Reggie White, who died of sleep apnea, Jerome Brown, who died in a car accident, and all the guys who died of cancer and all these other ailments, all these other things that happened in their lives wasn't just because of CTE. And some of these guys, it was because of, and especially some of the guys who died of suicide, who were dealing with depression issues and alcohol issues and drug issues because of painkillers and all these other things. It wasn't just brain. It was also part of their masculinity that didn't enable them to say, I am hurting. I need help. I am not this warrior who's impervious to pain and vulnerability and sensitivity and emotional breakdown. I am not. And so these guys are all taught to be warriors. And the same thing that makes them warriors are the same things that made them vulnerable. And it's also some of the same things that leads to men's violence against women. And so if we don't start talking to men and that's why when I talk about the blind spot of privilege, is part of privilege is, and this is in the case of Chris Gedney, the guy I was just telling you about a moment ago, who worked at Syracuse. He was a senior associate athletics director, and no one thought that Chris Gedney had a problem. But Chris Gedney had a lot of problems. And so all these people around him would say, oh, Chris Gedney's fine. Chris Gedney's fine. You talk to Chris Gedney, and Chris Gedney would say, oh, I'm living the dream. He wasn't living the dream. He was living a nightmare. And so part of that blind spot, that power and privilege, is that we think that we're okay. Hmm. And in many ways, we're not. And so when you see a mass shooter, you know, it's interesting, and not to get into the race politics of it, but there's a race politic to it. We don't want to examine masculinity with mass shooters. We say there's a shooting happens and we say, well, there must have been a mental health problem or access to guns. And so we have all this stuff about mental health and guns. But say for the last week when a woman walked into YouTube, virtually all the mass shooters were white men. And here's the part about the white man part. Talk about privilege, unchecked privilege, saying I don't have privilege. These white men were hurting. They were angry. They had no outlet for their anger. They were feeling, as you said a moment ago, they were feeling like something was being taken away from them. There was all this anger in what has been their narrow understanding of who they are, incapable of seeing a more global world, a more diverse world that felt like it was taking something away from them. That comes from a very narrow, hurting identity that we're not paying attention to.
Right, so we kind of struggle with the two sides of it, which is we need to stop sympathizing with the murderer, particularly because that usually only happens when he's a young white male, right? We try to figure out how he was wronged by society. But also on the other side, instead of taking sides, having a more nuanced and broader conversation about the ways in which we tell men what they should be doing in order to be a real man. And so if women aren't responding to them, or if they can't find a job, or if, like you said, because of a narrow view of probably those around them in the community they live in, they fear that things will be taken away from them because of rising equality amongst other groups, that we're not allowing for the way in which they show their anger or their fear, but we are seeking to understand it better versus just saying, you know, we're on one side or the other.
Yeah, and I think this does get into a really, deep conversation about where men are in our culture, because you're exactly right. This notion, and this is playing out. This played out in the last election. I think there was a lot to be said for what white men were feeling. And it wasn't just a matter of just simply about race, but if you think about, especially on a college campus, and I'm on college campuses all the time, and arguably one of the greatest marginalized voices on college campus right now are that of white men. It's not because they don't have voice, because they have tremendous voice and power and influence in so many different ways, but in a conversation like this, white men are completely marginalized. They're not allowed to talk. And around them, they're seeing LGBTQI issues being raised. They're seeing Black Lives Matter. They're seeing immigrants. They're seeing all these other different ways in which other people's voices are being heard, especially on a campus. But white men on college campuses are the villain. They're the representatives of the patriarchy. And there's, on the one hand, you say, okay, yeah, time for you to sit down and listen. But on the other hand, it's not validating their experiences. And they also are. You know, this is not a defense of white men, nor is an indictment of white men. It's just an understanding of where their voices are. But because I think they are the epitome of what I refer to as narrow masculinity, they have to live up to the ideal. They represent it. They represent what being a real man is in our culture, and that's and it's a very narrowly defined thing, and it's also a very big responsibility for them to bear.
You mentioned earlier that when you got to the new high school and you realized that you would be accepted because of sport, regardless of really what was going on as a person and who you are beyond that. I've talked on various shows in this podcast about how I don't think people are making a direct enough link to the sort of activities that went on at Louisville in terms of supplying strippers and prostitutes for young recruits, young male recruits, to try to sort of prove to them, if you come to Louisville and play here, women are at your disposal.
Right.
They're sort of trophies to be won by your athleticism. That very clearly can lead to the sort of entitlement and power structure that allows male athletes to be more likely to commit acts of sexual assault on campus, right? That so often we see it with athletes in part because we create a structure around them that says, we'll fix whatever happens, right? We've got a line with the local police, so if something goes wrong, we'll make sure to cover it up. And also that you are literally deserving of women by virtue of succeeding at sport. It feels like you were already onto that very early, right?
Yeah, and I think to the point you just mentioned, and I think this was the sort of, I think when you kind of threw that back to me, to if I was on that, I don't know if I was necessarily on it, but I will make a point of 2 points about that. One is when you said that that supplying prostitutes or supplying women for men as recruits says that they're going to be entitled, that's the very act of entitlement. That's the very act of ownership of women's bodies for men's purpose, for men's consumption. And so it's not even that you're telling them something, you're doing that thing. And the institution is responsible, is culpable for doing that thing that we then see as behavior that manifests in college students. They're already doing it, and they're already showing that women's bodies are disposable and used as tools, no different than, you know, back when I was coming up, it was like, you got a car, right? I mean, that is the complete objectification of women's and ownership of women's bodies by male culture. And I think that the thing that I saw that really bothered me, and it was a very subtle thing that I saw as a kid, was when men would do that, how to me it was degrading, not just to women but also to me, that I felt like it disrespected what my values were, and I think that's where very often why I say that the school is culpable for the behavior that nurtures in a kid is that it's disrespectful of that student athlete's values to do that, and obviously it nurtures a lot of troubling behavior. But not every, you know, college basketball player is that kind of person who's going to, you know, seize upon that. Nor was I, I think that practice that I saw personally was that it was very disrespectful of and dismissing of what my values were as a person.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, and I thought the same, especially when I heard that one of the recruits in that case didn't want to be in the room with the woman, and the coach sort of pushed him back in. No, go in there. And I wonder how much you think in an argument between nurture versus nature. Mm. I think a lot of people would say, well, you know, men just like sex and men are wired to always want to take this and this is what they need, versus how much we teach boys that this is what they should want, this is how they should go after it, this is how they should feel about taking it, or even to the point of, you know, if you're a virgin or if you haven't had, you know, much luck with women, that you're failing as a man. How much are we teaching versus how much do you actually believe that there is a difference between the genders?
Well, there's a difference between the genders, because there's a difference between the sexes, and that's natural. We procreate, and the argument of nature versus nurture, really to me is very frustrating. It's both. It's as far as Gump said. You're right. It's both. It's nature and nurture. We are. You know, I have testosterone and I produce sperm. Right. You have estrogen and you produce an egg, and that's how life is formed between two human beings that form life. And so there's your nature, and along with that comes of all the things that make us who we are as physical human beings for the different purposes that we serve in the anthropological conversation. There's that, and there's also the nurture in a culture that wants college students to talk about sexual violence but does not want to talk about sex. In a culture that mm-hmm. wants to not have a comprehensive sex and intimacy education in our schools, and yet our 5, 6, 7-year-old boys are already addicted to pornography on mobile devices, that pornography that is violently misogynistic and violently rape. I tell young men, if you didn't learn about sex and intimacy, and young women, from the people who raised you, and I ask this question of college students around the country on a regular basis, how many of you got a graphic, honest, and sustained conversation from the people who raised you, from the people who taught you please and thank you? How many of you from those people got a comprehensive conversation about intimacy, sexual behavior, foreplay, your body, all of that? And no hands go up. And in no case, over the last 25 years of asking that question, do maybe 2 or 3 hands go up in a room of 100 people. And so the question to everybody else is, where did you learn about it? And ultimately, and this is what I believe, and you talked about it, this ultimately, I believe, is one of the greatest public health crises of this generation. is the impact of pornography and graphic pornography that's accessible on mobile devices that young boys are being addicted to and are being trained to. And so when you say, just like I said earlier, we train to make good decisions in sports. So who's training our young people to make good decisions around intimacy and sexual behavior?
Right.
It's not parents. We're still afraid to talk about it. We're still afraid to give our kids the sex talk in any honest way. And so if parents are silent, if the adults are silent, if the culture is silent, and kids have access to really graphic and dehumanizing and essentially rape by category. And I ask college men all the time, if you didn't get it from your parents, where'd you get it? And sometimes they'll give me the name of the website. They'll give me the name of the porn site.
Right.
Where they're seeing what I refer to as rape by category. And then you ask them where they, so you have the nurture, the nature. Yes, they have the urges to be sexually active. Of course, so do women. It's then how do you act it? What does the performance of that sexual intimacy intimacy and sexual behavior look like? What informs how you behave in those moments? And if in the silence of adults, in the absence of any kind of real conversation, what you get is what you get from pornography.
Right. I just talked about this last week on the podcast because there was a great pod from a podcast called The Second Captains, which includes some former footballers out in Ireland. And they talked about a rape case involving some players, but then it became this really wide-ranging conversation about consent and what we teach kids. And they got into pornography a lot, too. And, you know, I think it was an interesting space for this to be happening on a podcast that's got, you know, these really well-known former footballers. And I wonder, when you walk into a room and you can introduce yourself as a Syracuse superstar who, you know, was second in the Heisman voting, who went on to play in the NFL, how do you think what you're saying when you identify yourself as a feminist, when you want to talk about, you know, gendered roles, is digested differently because you're able to come in and represent something that we associate with masculinity?
There's no question. When I met Jackson Katz in 1994, and he had in 1993 created the Mentors in Violence Prevention Program, his idea was to identify men whose privilege and whose masculinity could not be questioned, and men who were going to speak out about gender-based violence who had some status, and clearly as a former athlete and as a former football player. There's no question about it that gives me some gravitas with whether it's a room full of football players or a room full of men in general, or men and some women, student athletes, having been someone who sat in their chairs and in their shoes, certainly gives you some credibility in the conversation. But I actually worked very hard to move away from that because it feels of which I refer to what I refer to as protective patriarchy. The same sexism that says that men need to be narrowly defined also says that men need to use that narrow definition of masculinity to be protectors. And I refer to that as protective patriarchy. Right, so men never escape this role of having to play that I'm the man who's going to tell you what things are like because I'm the man who's going to protect you, sort of thing. Like I would say, the same man who tells his son look after your mother, as in other words, take care of your mother, as if it's a boy's responsibility to physically protect his mother, mm-hmm. is the same father who looks at another man and says take care of my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and so it's men never escape this role of being protectors, and therefore that justifies the narrow masculinity with which we're defined, because we need to be tough and strong to protect the people around us.
You get this power, so then you can't complain about the fact that there are so many ways that you're limited and not allowed to be a whole human.
And not only that, but that. The same women who are asking men to lay down that patriarchy are also asking men like me to use my patriarchy to teach men not to be abusive.
Right.
Right? And so there's this really, you know, and like I said, this is a complicated conversation, but there's this piece where we as men need to have this conversation, and that's the point that I do make when I go talk to men in particular, is that I'm not here just to tell you not to be a rapist or not to be an abuser. I'm here to help you see how we as men need to encourage and allow each other to live in our wholeness, to live in authenticity, so not that it not only leads to the diminish and lack of men's violence against women, but that it also leads to men living in their whole authentic selves. And that's, to me, the sustainable conversation, and the conversation that men need to have that is intergenerational. And I think that's one of the things that I very often have to work against, because if I walk into the room with credibility because I was a football player, then I have to dismantle, and I have to dismantle the privilege that I walk into the room with, because not every man in the room is going to have that privilege. Not every, right. And so I have to walk and almost dismantle that privilege in order for them to see in me where they fit in the conversation.
So I wonder, and this might be too deep a dive, but I'm curious, what happens then when the message that you're sending, which is a very smart one and a very necessary one, gets conflated with the idea of men's rights movements, that we are addressing too much the needs of women, that women are now succeeding in all these ways that men are not necessarily in education and otherwise, that we don't go too far over to one side now where we neglect the fact that as flawed as our view of masculinity is, we still live in a patriarchy. There is a tremendous amount of male privilege. There is still a power swing towards men, so that we can fix the things that need to be fixed when it comes to men and boys and masculinity without swinging so far to men's rights that we leave behind women yet again.
I think that's the to me, it's not as difficult as a conversation. It's why I said earlier that I was not talking in defense nor an indictment of white men when I was talking about white men and patriarchy and privilege. It wasn't an indictment or an excuse. It was a reality. And in order for people to live in their authenticity, live in their wholeness, and live in their fullness, they have to be seen. They have to be heard, which is one of the reasons why college campuses are so diverse, and why our people are saying, these are my pronouns, and these are how I want to be seen. That's a necessary. It's messy. It's difficult, but it's necessary. And I think the argument that this conversation is going to move towards the men's rights conversation is one that is part of the fear. And it's a legitimate fear that men are going to, that men are sort of going to dominate. This is only going to be about taking care of men. But it won't. The reality is that it won't stand up, because if we truly have this conversation about men living in their authenticity and their wholeness, who men are is way more diverse than we give it credit, and that we expect it to be. And who men are is not. When I say who men are, who male people are, is way more diverse than we give it credit. And when we truly allow people to live in their wholeness and live in their authenticity, I believe this, and that means being vulnerable and sensitive and loving and caring, and not just saying that we allow men to say, yeah, I'm a tough guy and that's all I am and that's all I ever want to be. Well, that's BS. Because that's also it's not natural. We are all those things. We are vulnerable, sensitive, caring, empathetic, passive, submissive. When we nurture our men to live in their wholeness, and to see being a man not as better than or less than, what the men's rights movement is trying to do is really just trying to say, I don't need to change, and I want to maintain the power and the privilege I have. And part of the power and privilege that they have is the power and privilege not to change or see other people.
Right.
And that's just not going to happen.
Right. That's absolutely the point then, right? It's not about addressing men's needs so much as desiring not to change and see the needs of others. One last thing I'd love your insight on. Old friend from LA, Doyen Richards, went viral because he had one young daughter strapped to his chest in a baby carrier, and he was doing the hair of his other daughter. And it became this big thing. Oh, what a great father, right? There was also a lot of issues with people making racial comments about how he probably went to go deal drugs right after that, right? There was this total backlash, but there was also this really positive response of like, wow, this dad taking care of his kids. And it was almost insulting to fathers that this idea that just doing the work of raising your kids should be promoted in a way that what a hero, right? As opposed to just saying you're just raising your kids. It's like fathers don't babysit their kids when their wife's away. They
exactly.
raise them. And I found the same issues with LeVar Ball in some ways. He was being raised up as this great model of black fatherhood because he was around. And I wanted to have a nuanced conversation about how that was actually insulting to the and played right into the stereotypes of black fatherhood to say that somebody who was pulling his kids out of AAU games because he didn't agree with the ref, taking him out of high school because he wanted to go try to make him go pro in some other country, you know, arguing with women, telling women to stay in their lane, was not actually representative of a good father. Someone who is a complete and utter public misogynist is not a great father, right? That's a huge blind spot in how he's raising his kids. And it felt to me like it was really difficult to have a nuanced conversation about the expectations that we have for men. And when we congratulate them or hold them up as a great, you know, leader in some way for very minimal behavior that should be expected, it actually is bad for them. It's bad for men in general. What do you make of sort of the way we do that sometimes where we say, this is so great and heroic, but in reality, we're just making the bar so low?
I think one of the biggest problems that is in everything you just said, you're exactly right. By the way, in what that says, I don't remember who it was, but there was a former NFL player whose son got caught with weed, and not to disparage who the player was or his son, and then he was seen as someone posted, "Oh, father of the year," because he yanked his son from the school where he was playing because he got caught with weed, and no, father of the year is not that guy. I'm sorry, father of the year is all the fathers who taught their sons not to smoke weed when they got a scholarship to go to an outstanding academic institution and get an education and play sports. Those are the fathers of the year. Those are the and part of the problem with everything that you said is that we tend to, and this is where sports, and I believe that sports is wonderful in many ways, but sports in American culture, in my opinion, has been a cancer for decades. And it has so because it has distorted so many. Sports was never about building integrity and teamwork and leadership. All that stuff is crap. If you tell me that sports builds character and integrity, then the people in the NFL should be the best at it. They should be they should have the most character, the most integrity. Yep. If sports builds character and teaches all those great altruistic things that we've all preached for years, then you should have no problem with NFL players, no problem with Olympians.
Or college coaches, right? The leaders of young men.
They should all be the epitome of all the altruism. And that's why it's BS, because they're not. In many cases, and I always say that as an athlete, I was the most self-centered, self-absorbed, egomaniacal person you can meet. I win, you lose. That's it, right? That's the proposition. And so when you look at what sports has become in our culture and all this nonsense, and I do think there's a huge racist element. The term role model didn't come into play with athletes until black men were making more money playing sports. And all of a sudden it was like, well, you better be a better person because all these young black kids who have no other role models to look at are looking at you. Well, that's utter and complete racist BS. And so this notion that you know, whether it's LeVar Ball, I have no idea who this man is. I refuse to even give him an ounce of my attention.
Good approach, yes.
Right, because he's a caricature. He's a manufacturer of such an absurd and grotesque interpretation of what American sports culture is, especially for black people, that it is an insult to black culture. Of what he is. He's a caricature of I'm going to commodify my son in this grotesque world that has distorted play for a multi-billion dollar industry, that has distorted the dreams of young kids to just go out and play. Now, I'm not talking about go out and make a bunch of money. I'm talking about go out and playing. We've co-opted play and turned it into a multi-billion dollar industry, and then we've created all these caricatures around us with this false value system within that. And so, not to get into, like you said, this is another whole can of worms about the impact of sports culture, but I think that you're exactly right that we create these false senses of, listen, you can, and I, many years ago I created something called the Sports Leadership Institute, and the whole idea was to really use the platform of sports to train athletes to be role models, to actually stand on something, on something of principle. And I remember sitting with the trustees at this school, and one of the trustees said to me, what athlete out there embodies what you're trying to accomplish? And I said, they don't exist. If you know of that athlete, they're part of a business already that has been co-opted by all sorts of messaging about what sports is about. And so... It's as I said this a minute ago, I think sports has become a big problem in our culture, and is also a big problem for the black community. And we tend to see that those athletes who play professionally are the successful men in our communities, and they're successful in their ability to play their sport, but their ability to play their sport is also part of a multi-billion dollar industry that's really not about them. And
yeah.
I, you know, when I was playing ball, I remember when guys started making $1 million, I started thinking, well, if Randall Cunningham can make $1 million, how much does, how much does Norm Brayman make? You know, how much does our owner make on a regular basis? If he can afford to pay one of his employees $1 million, he's making a lot of money. And so you just become a pawn in a much larger system, and we think that that's success.
Yeah, you know, John Amici has been kind of talking more publicly about the idea that we mythologize sport in a way that pretends like all the good stuff that can come from it is the only result and the inevitable result, when in fact there is so much else that happens, and we have to be more, honest about our sports and what they can and can't do.
Yep.
Hey, it was so great to talk to you, Don. I really appreciate the time, and I do hope to have you back on sometime when we can talk about the NCAA thing.
Yeah, anytime, sir. It's my pleasure.
Really appreciate it. Thanks, Don.
Oh, and another thing.
So this week's That's What She Read relates directly to what I just talked to Don about, John Amici, who I first was introduced to. Of course, I'd heard of him as an NBA player, but as a recurring guest on the Dan Le Batard Show, as an out male athlete who came out after he was done playing and has spent so much time sort of talking about society and sports and where they intersect, has a lot in common with Don McPherson in terms of trying to have these really nuanced and powerful conversations post-career. And exactly what Don spoke about near the end of the pod there, the idea that we mythologize sport and we pretend that it's, the best for our young people and we can use sport for great things. And in a lot of ways we can, right? There's so many examples, whether it's something like J.J. Watt and the amount of money that he was able to raise for the Houston flooding because of who he was, or athletes like Don McPherson and John Amici and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar that take the power that they earned through sport and they use it for good. There are absolutely ways that sports are wonderful. And my own personal experience, sports made me who I am. But when we have a blind spot to the other many ways that sports can be destructive in society, we really fail to best utilize the power of it and to control and harness the ways in which it can be damaging. So there's a story by a CNN author, Jill Martin, and the headline is John Amici, quote, "We have to stop mythologizing sport." It's back from January of this year. And it's just one of many. If you search for John Amici and you search that quote of mythologizing sport, you'll get a lot of other results talking about it. And even on his Twitter account, he did. But he did an interview with Amanda Davies in CNN Sport and just really got into the idea that, we don't always, and it was essentially based on Larry Nassar, right? That there are ways in which sports end up protecting even the worst among us. And like a church or another institution, people are so want to protect the thing that they love, even in the face of overwhelming evidence that something bad has gone on there. And that's the way in which sport can really be damaging. So again, the story is John Amici, We Have to Stop Mythologizing Sport by Jill Martin on CNN.com if you want to search for it. Thanks as always for lasting about an hour with me.
That's what she said.